underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Stephen Merrill Block frequently covers bleak territory in his novels. His latest, Oliver Loving, is no exception. Block takes us inside the mind of a comatose West Texas teen who has been hit in the head during a mass shooting on the night of his high school prom. The novel is a portrait of a small West Texas town divided by race and left behind by the rest of the country, and of a family transformed by tragedy and tested by their desperation to reach Oliver. Again, the name of the novel is Oliver Loving, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Merrill Block to this week's Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What brought you to this particular subject? How much of it was a school shooting? How much of it was Texas?
Well, it was both things, certainly. When I was a teenager, I grew up in a town in Texas, not as far west as where the novel takes place. I grew up in Plano, Texas, in the late 90s. It had been a smaller town, and it was in the process of becoming part of the exurbs of Dallas. It was, at that time, the fastest growing city in America. It went from like 20,000 to like 250,000 people in a very short span of time. With all of that sudden prosperity also came some tremendous darkness. Before I was a teenager, in the late 80s, media dubbed Plano the suicide capital of America because 8 children from my town died in this suicide epidemic. And then when I was a teenager there, tragedy struck again. This time it was a spate of heroin overdoses and also suicides. 18 kids from my town died in a year and a half when I was like 16 and 17. This is all now 20 years in the past, and Plano has gone on, and it's continued to grow, and the memories have in some ways faded. But every time I go back home, I feel haunted by the legacy of those years and of the children that we lost. As that was happening, the events at Columbine occurred, and I felt a strong kinship with what they were going through because, there was another large suburban high school. Looked very much like our own, and those two events, the epidemic of overdoses and suicides in my town, and the massacre at Columbine, sort of fused in my mental adolescent landscape. So every time I see the news of these mass shootings, which are just all too common, I think about my town, and I think about how, in the midst of that tragedy, media arrived, and we had. The country's attention, for better or worse, for a while, and then something else happens, and the story moves on. And I think when I see the coverage of these shootings, I think the true horror and the true story of what happens after one of these massive losses of young life is just often not told because attention drifts elsewhere, and that feeling just felt unbearably lonely to me. So I, in some ways, began this novel to try to tell the longer story. And as you say, Texas is also a major influence in this novel. I moved away when I was 18, but around the time I started writing Oliver Loving, I went back to Texas for a 6-month stay at this amazing writing fellowship called the Dobie Paisano Fellowship. I was at a ranch in the hill country just west of Austin. And so I was like back in the sort of landscape of my childhood, and I also made many visits to my hometown, and so as I was reckoning with my own personal past, I was also thinking a lot about the history of the state, its myths and legends, and its history of tremendous violence and of sudden affluence and loss. So both of those things are really central to the novel.
I want to get back to some of that in just a moment, but also just this idea of nearly 10 years after of Oliver lying in his bed, silent and paralyzed, and how his family reacts to that and the struggles that they go through. Was there something in particular that you wanted to explore there, perhaps a real-life event that inspired that timing of it, of what happened so many years later?
Yeah, you know, as I was thinking about my town's history and the state's history, I think a feeling that a lot of people have when they return to their hometowns, and if you're lucky enough to be able to visit your high school bedroom, which I am, my parents are still in the same house, you have the feeling that a past form of yourself still lives there and sleeps in that bed, and in some ways demands an accounting for the decisions you've made as an adult, and that moment is frozen in time. So I had that feeling, and as I was, you know, thinking of that, I happened to read this true story of a man in Belgium named Rom Huben. And Rom Huben's story is truly harrowing, and I just couldn't put it down, and I kept thinking about it and retelling it in my own ways. And the story is that this man, Rom, when he was young, got into a terrible car crash. He went into a coma and was diagnosed at the time by doctors as being in a persistent vegetative state or minimally conscious. Doctors essentially thought that he was brain dead. He was put into a state hospital where he remained for the following 17 years. 17 years later, an enterprising doctor came to Rom's hospital to subject him to a new form of neuroimaging. You know, mostly when the doctors subject people who have been diagnosed as minimally conscious for that many years to neuroimaging, they see brains that have shriveled from inactivity, and you know, they see minds that are just truly not present anymore. What this doctor saw when he looked at Rom Huben's brain under this fMRI was a brain that appeared to function normally. It seemed that Rom was responding to words and to stimulus, and what he concluded was that Rom had been wrongly diagnosed, or perhaps something had changed, but probably wrongly diagnosed and been trapped in his body the whole time. Of course, you know, on the one hand, it's a miracle for the family that, you know, the son who they thought was lost is still present. On the other hand, it's the worst horror you can imagine. This person has had to suffer this imprisonment in his body all those years. They were desperate, of course, to find a way for Rom to communicate. They hired a speech pathologist who employed a controversial form of speech therapy called facilitated communication. Facilitated communication is mostly used with nonverbal people with autism and people who have suffered severe stroke. It's controversial because it requires a really intimate participation of the speech pathologist to help the patient speak. In Rom's case, the speech pathologist felt some faint movement in Rom's hand, you know, little twitches. And using these twitches, she helped guide Rom's hands along a keyboard. And so for the first time in 17 years, Rom was speaking. And what came out of Rom's keyboard, of his computer voice, was a kind of poetry. It was hopeful and it was lyrical. And he talked of his rebirth. He talked of how grateful he was to still be alive. It was exactly the story that a parent who had witnessed all of this and been present for all those years would want to hear. It became a kind of sensation, media sensation. But when watching coverage of this from New York City, there was a professor at NYU who became suspicious because, you know, he knew the sort of problematic history of facilitated communication. Long story short, they subjected Rom and the speech therapist to a series of tests. They would kick the speech therapist out of the room, show Rom objects or sing him songs, tell him stories, bring the speech therapist back in the room. And when they asked Rom what they had shown him while she was out of the room, he couldn't answer. So The conclusion was that Rom was indeed awake and aware and present, but he was still incapable of typing a single word. The horror of that is, of course, immense. I think one of the reasons why it resonated with me so deeply, well, first is this notion of speaking with, you know, this lost former self, that you could bring that person back and ask them questions. Is just the possibility of that is so irresistible and profound. That was, you know, a big part of the attraction of the story to me was, you know, I felt at this moment in my life in some ways in conversation with my own past self. But more deeply, I just felt like the story said something profound about the ways that family members relate to one another. I could understand very well the desperation that allowed his family to believe that, you know, despite probably some evidence that had come up along the way, that this voice indeed belonged to Rom Huben. And not just in families, in all relationships, like we all carry fictions of one another. Each person's perspective on a central story will never quite be the same, but we need these stories about each other in order to hold us together.
The name of the novel is Oliver Loving. Stephen Merrill Block is the author, and the book is published by Flatiron. The beauty of this book is the hope that is there, not only for Oliver, but for his family and for the town itself. The town itself very much plays a role in this, as mm-hmm. far as the erasing, if you will, of that horrendous event that had happened so many years prior.
Yeah, you know, I think hope is really the central question of the book. There's an element of mystery to this novel. Oliver was struck by a bullet the night of the dance by a shooter whose motives remain pretty obscure to the people of the town. It's the question that everyone howls at the camera right after one of these events happens, which is why. And that question of why lingers, even if there are apparent explanations. Like, you, in some ways, you'll never be able to give a full accounting for why someone could choose to do something so horrible. But the town pins a lot of hope on this boy who hasn't spoken, but maybe some part of him remains inside of his body. And of course, you know, the novel more primarily is concerned with his family's hope. His mother Eve has sat by his bedside every day for 10 years in conversation with this boy, even if he's never been able to speak back. The novel also follows two other characters. His father, who, you know, has tried to sort of blank away his grief through his own artwork and through alcoholism, and his brother, who is off in New York City trying to tell a story about all this. He's trying to be a writer and trying to grapple with his brother's legacy and in some way bring his brother back through writing. But the question of hope is interesting to me here. I mean, I think ultimately the book, you know, for all of its tragic material, has a somewhat of a hopeful feeling to it. I wanted to write the novel with the sort of levity and also humor that feels like a major part of how we deal with grief. But I was also interested in the paradox of hope that's at the heart of this book, which is there's this hope that Oliver has survived, that some part of him has survived, and that hope is what allows his mother is so intensely hopeful and watchful, and so allows his survival. On the other hand, it's her hope that possibly has confined him in the worst imaginable state. So, you know, hope can be also a destructive thing. And I was interested in that sort of irresolvable paradox.
Tie together for us, if you can, the relationship between this story and the story you wanted to tell with Oliver Loving and the classmates and the friends that you lost during your high school years.
I lost a few friends and acquaintances, and also at the end of that terrible time, our school counselor killed herself in this way that was, you know, hugely traumatizing for the entire school. I feel in some way when I go back to Plano that there's this desire to speak to those people. They'll forever remain trapped at 16. The children who died will forever remain trapped at 16 and 17. They can never, you know, explain to me their exact reasons, and I can never try to tell them that life gets better and that the dire moment would have passed for them. And, you know, there's a one-way conversation that happens in loss for all of us. And, you know, I think the closer a person was to you, the more you find yourself speaking to this voice that just can never speak back. And so, you know, in my novel, I wanted to dramatize that feeling and make it more literal, I suppose.
The idea of the town really being left behind by the country, how much of that is by what happened in that town, but also perhaps just the fact that it is a town in West Texas?
Yeah, you know, there are parts of Texas that are, you know, incredibly affluent and expanding at you know, a rapid rate. I think the whole Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex is like that, or Austin. And then, you know, the state is as large as France, so there are huge swaths of it that, you know, at one moment in their histories had commerce or reason that people were there. And then, you know, it often was about, you know, mineral excavation or oil. And when the, you know, the precious substance left the earth, so the town, you know, was sort of went to seed. So there are a lot of towns in West Texas that to me have the feeling of Bliss, which is my invented town in this novel. These are towns that feel like they're just hanging on by, you know, one or two last little threads of commerce. And I was interested in, you know, the forgotten parts of America, which is, you know, I started to write this novel 6 years ago, in the midst of the Obama years when I think that group of people was less a subject of, national consideration. But I think as a writer, and probably most writers are attracted to, you know, out of the way places and forgotten places. There's something attractive about being able in fiction to tell the stories of people and voices that often aren't represented. So I was attracted to that. I also spent some time in West Texas as a kid, and it's a part of the state that just, you know, it's like the mythic, you know, Wild West part of Texas. It still looks relatively untouched from its, you know, from its cowboy days. There's just it feels like you're stepping out of time when you go there, and it, you know, it's also so inaccessible. It's hours from anything. So in some ways, as a fiction writer, you can have a probably false, but some sense of ownership over that territory. And it's also a politically conflicted area. I mean, not just because of the withering of, you know, the historical industries in those towns, but Bliss is set right along the border of Mexico. And so has become, you know, those border towns have become, of course, a flashpoint and a renewed debate over immigration.
It's so interesting, and you write about this beautifully in the novel, but it's the town, of course, is very much marked by before this tragedy and after this tragedy, mm-hmm. which, of course, is the same for the young man who was hit in the head with this bullet. But with that said, as time goes on, people become more detached to the actual event. And mm-hmm. it becomes something that is more of a story than something that was really directly felt by those people who are still at the bedside of those who are very much impacted.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly the story I wanted to tell, that, you know, as the horrors fade from memory and from attention, that the true agony and the true legacy of events like these, of shootings, or just any sudden loss of sudden and somewhat inexplicable loss of life, is shouldered by families whose stories, you know, aren't followed for the years and decades that maybe they ought to be, as we debate these topics, you know, that. You know, the events of one night echo for generations often, and I wanted to tell that story.
When you think about Oliver and what Oliver was going through, obviously you mentioned the true life story of Rahm Rubin, but how interested were you in other victims of school violence, of school shootings?
I mean, quite, I guess. I think like anyone, I can't look away from the coverage when one of these terrible events occurs. You know, when I set out to write the novel, I decided that there was going to be a shooting at the heart of it. This was 6 years ago. There had been other, you know, of course, other terrible shootings. It hadn't quite reached the pitch that it has now, where it's almost horribly routine. And so when I began, I thought, in some ways, readers might take this as a comment on one particular event, which was Columbine. But then, you know, over the years it took to write this, it became just the atmosphere around us. And in that way, it felt like more and more of an urgent story to tell. It's something that I haven't seen many fiction writers wrestle with. I think largely because the story, you know, is inherently so tragic. If you're telling a tragic story, you have to find, this is what I really, you know, worked on in writing this novel, so you have to find ways to tell it with, you know, the sort of levity and humor of how we actually cope with sorrow. So I would say all the events, all the shootings that have happened over the years it took to write this, I've, you know, been paying very close attention to the ways that families and towns and government responds to all of that. And either directly or subconsciously, I think that whole entire gun violence atmosphere has worked its way into this novel.
I was reading this novel as this was an item in the news, and I found the parallels interesting. But one of the things that I didn't know but was fascinating, that you really look over the academic year, and a day does not go by, much less a week, without a school shooting. What I found interesting and fascinating, which I, again, did not know, is that many of those, of course, are mass shootings, but the large majority are suicides. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you, in your personal situation, dealt with a lot of suicide as well as a lot of drug overdose and drug abuse. So there is that connection, isn't there, between the gun issue and the gun violence, but also that idea of wanting to take your own life.
Yeah, and you know, and so often, especially with teenagers, it becomes a murder suicide. And I think every suicide has a different motive, and every school shooting has a different motive. And you know, I can't speak to everyone who would make that terrible decision. But in my novel, I don't remember the exact quote I have, but there's something about how the gun was a machine that could convert private agony into public sorrow, that it's a way to take the pain that an individual is feeling and make a community feel it. And I think that's often a reason why this happens so catastrophically and explosively. I also think that in some ways it must be related to the rise of social media and the internet culture, that just within this generation, there's this way in which like our lives are happening in our own private news streams. And I think if you were sitting with profound sorrow and anger, you might imagine that you could perform this one act that would, you see all the attention that it could bring to you. And I think that's a part of the gun violence discussion that isn't brought up enough. You know, we're always talking about like changing the gun laws, and of course that has to happen. But I also think that there's something that has to do with the seduction of the darkest kind of fame that's also part of this discussion.
We've of course been talking about the act of violence and the shooting aspect of this novel. We also spoke about how hope is very much at the core of this, but so is family and the functional and the dysfunctional of a family unit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, ultimately, for all of its themes, this is a family novel. In all senses of what a family novel contains, you know, it's about the stories that hold a family together and the stories that can break a family apart. As a writer, one of the things that interests me most is telling the same story from multiple perspectives. And I think in family, this is especially intriguing because everyone is so close. And in many ways, the foundational myths, the foundational stories of the family are shared. And yet it means something different to each family member. And when there's a central dilemma, as there is in this book, of will this lost boy come back? Is this really Oliver speaking? What are we to make of his words? That question is wrestled with in very different ways by the different family members. And I don't know, I'm just fascinated by the sort of invisible calculus of the way different minds come to the same problem.
And that learning of the limits of communication, I also found fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's a central theme to almost everything I write. In all three of my novels, there's a central darkness, and it's a place that exists beyond our understanding, our language, really. In my first novel, I dealt with late stage Alzheimer's. My second novel dealt with lightly autobiographical with a grandfather who had died long before I was born. And in this novel, you know, there's of course this boy who is in his hospital bed, literally without words. I'm always interested in the story of how people project language into places that they can't know. Part of that is just me considering my own position as a fiction writer, because I think as other narrative forms of art are increasingly popular. I'm thinking of binge-worthy television and film.
Right.
The novel needs to make a case for itself, and that means a lot of different things to a lot of different novelists. But for me, a big part of what that means is the question of what can fiction do that nothing else can do, and what fiction can do, I think, is give you the feeling of being inside another person's consciousness. And fiction, more than film or television, can reach into, through an act of imagination, can reach into places that nothing else can reach. So I think that's why I'm always attracted to the stories of people who can't speak for themselves, because it feels like like only fiction can reach into those places.
The name of the novel is Oliver Loving. It is published by Flatiron Books. Stephen Merrill Block, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. This was so nice. I really appreciate it.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.